Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, April 25th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. All right, this week I want to thank those of you who have made Talk Nerdy possible by visiting karasantamaria.com and clicking through the links to support the show via PayPal or Patreon. I also want to thank those of you who visited the Talk Nerdy store this week. We got a lot of stuff back in stock, so don't forget to stop on by. Specifically through the Patreon portal, which you can also visit by going to www.patreon.com/talknerdy. I want to first and foremost thank Phil T-Bear and Timothy Glover. I also want to thank our newest supporter, Charles Payet, as well as Jafe, the Honorable Husband, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and last but definitely not least, I want to thank Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you all so much from the bottom of my heart, you guys. All right, I'm really excited about this week's episode. This week I sit down with Leela Higgins, and she is the manager of citizen science at my local museum, the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. It's a lot of fun, so here she is. Leela Higgins. Well, Leela, thank you so much for joining me today.
No problem. Excited to be here.
So you just finished a camping trip.
I did. We went to the Kern River and stayed at this campground called Hobo Campground. Mm-hmm. It's right on the river, and it's like so perfect. We kind of rolled up, and we left at 5 a.m. because we had no reservations. Like, is there going to be a spot? It's like, there's going to be one spot left just for us. We roll in, the guy's like, there's one spot left.
That's awesome.
It was so good.
And so wait, tell for people who aren't from LA, where are these places?
So you go north of LA up to Bakersfield on the 5 freeway, and then you get onto the 99, and then you go up into the mountains, and you follow the river up through the mountains, and then right before you get to Lake Isabella, you hang a right and follow a river down a creek, and or down a canyon, rather.
And which mountains are they? Are they the? Is it in the Angeles National Forest? Or I don't know any of these things.
I really should know.
I'm like Santa Susana.
I'm like, I know Tehachapi's up there, so okay. Maybe it's the Tehachapi Mountains. Yeah, I could totally made that up, I think.
I like it. It works for me. So, for those who don't know, because why would they know? Because I haven't told them yet. Tell everybody listening what it is you do for a living, because it's absolutely fascinating and there's so much we get to talk about.
So I work at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County, and I'm the manager of citizen science.
So what is citizen science? That's probably the most common question you get asked, right?
All the time. Citizen science, who's he, what he? Yeah, citizen science is getting non-scientists involved in the scientific process to answer real-world questions. And the real-world questions that we have at the museum basically are about the nature of Los Angeles. I was just about to say, sure, we also have like dinosaurs and things like that and paleontological research going on. We haven't really gone into citizen science in that arena yet, but who knows, maybe around the corner.
Oh, that would be cool. I wonder if they do that at the tar pits. Did they do anything with the public?
They're just starting to do some stuff. Gotcha. But we've definitely had school kids come in and do facilitated sorting of microfossils. Cool. So that could be something that we kind of get into in the future.
So basically, citizen science is free labor. No, I'm kidding.
Well, we don't necessarily like to think about it like that in the citizen science practitioner community, because I get to geek out with a bunch of other people who are practitioners of citizen science. And it's kind of like this two-way street. Like, people come to us because they want to be involved in this kind of work. And then us practitioners try to make sure that they don't get used as free labor and that they're getting what they want out of it. And that they're, if they want to learn something, they're getting learning out of it. If they want to have a social experience, they can get a social experience out of it. If they want to get up close and hang out with researchers, then we try to provide, again, meet them where they're at.
I feel like I got close to citizen science at NHMLA probably last year, or maybe it was 2 years ago now, when I was at SoCal Connected, and I did a story about the, we called it the bug bet, but about the BioScan.
Oh, project. Yeah, BioScan.
So BioScan's a big citizen science initiative we have going on here, right?
Yep.
So,
and we're in phase two of BioScan right
already.
Now. Yep.
And so BioScan, first, where does the name come from? Like, what does that mean?
So our entomologist, Dr. Brian Brown, he's one of the world's leading forage fly researchers. He loves and is amazing at coming up with acronyms. I'm pretty partial to acronyms myself, but he's just like comes up with them like nobody's business. You need an acronym? Oh, I'll come up with one. So he came up with BioScan, which means Biodiversity, Science, City, and Nature.
Ah.
BioScan.
And I love that because it really, it kind of implies what we love so much about LA is that it's like this urban, there's so much urban wildlife here. You
yep.
know, it is a city, but there's so much nature that if you just kind of stop and look, you'll actually see it. And BioScan specifically involves people who kind of sign up to be citizen scientists, and then they have these traps in their backyards.
Yep, Malaise Traps with a capital M because it's named after a man whose last name was Malaise.
Oh, that's a
and
bummer.
Apparently
that his last name was
he, yeah, I know. But apparently he left his tent open and he went out to go and collect insects, and then got back and realized that the tent had caught more insects than he had. And so he's like, I'm adapting this. And now researchers all over the world use Malaise Traps.
I love that. And so there are these. They're pretty big, actually. I mean, they're not invasive. Like, they look cool in people's backyards.
Yeah.
But they're these big traps that have basically, like, a buckety thing in it. And then the researchers come, what, like, once a week or however often they come?
Yeah. So they were doing it, changing out the jars once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now that they've moved down to not changing the jars so frequently, so it's every other week or every month.
Nice.
But I work really closely with the researchers on this and get to have parties with the citizen scientists and be like, thank you for being a citizen scientist. Now let's cheers to you.
I love that. So a big part of your job is celebrating.
Yes. Got to celebrate the work that people have put in.
Yeah, for sure. I'm going to take a second to let Killer leave the room because he is chuffing, maybe? I think big cats chuff. I don't know if dogs chuff. But he's making a chuffy type sound at the door. He's being a jerk, actually. So I'll be right back. Everybody, sing the Jeopardy song for a second. Go away. Go away. You're bothering me. Thank you. Okay. And I'm back. So a lot of individual citizens in LA actually participate in BioScan, both in phase one and phase two. And I think the coolest part is that if they find a new species, or if a new species is found in their malaise trap, they get to name it.
So the first 30 traps were in people's backyards. And one of my friends at the museum, Emily Hartop, she went through hundreds of flies. Thousands. I can't remember how many thousands she went through.
Yeah.
Like something ridiculous. Like tens of thousands. And she found 30 new species of fly. And each one was able to be named after, or the citizen scientist family that hosted the trap was able to help come up with what they wanted the name to be. So some of them kind of chose children's names. Mm-hmm. Some of them chose other things. But I think that was a really amazing way to honor the work that they had done by having these traps in their backyard for, I think it was close to 3 years. So it was
a long
time. Maybe it was 2.5. But, multiple years having
yeah.
this trap in your backyard.
And having a researcher come to their house like every week.
Exactly.
And empty that jar. So 30 new species. That's a lot.
Well, now it's up to 42.
That's insane. So yeah. 42 new species. Literally right here in LA, like flies that have never been categorized by science before.
Yep.
That's
new
incredible.
Species never before been described, and it happened here in LA.
Did anybody name their fly Flyy McFlyface?
I wish that was on the thing, because I was a big proponent of Boaty McBoatface.
Yeah.
And I was like, this makes me proud to be British. Yes, we should name it Boaty McBoatface. I think it won in the polls, but I highly doubt that
yeah.
the panel are going to be like, yes, we should totally name it that.
They're so going to shut it down. But if they went with Boaty McBoatface, it would be epic.
He'd be even prouder to be British at that point.
So when did you come over here to the States?
I moved in 1994, which was halfway through freshman year of high school. So that was really fun.
Yeah, what a bummer. Was it hard to, is it hard for the British girl to make friends? Or is it kind of like, ooh, British girl.
Exactly. Well, like, everyone's like, oh, start speaking like me. Thankfully, I didn't take it as they were mocking me. They're just like, we love your accent.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
Did you move here to LA?
I moved to the Inland Empire. So from the British Empire to the Inland Empire, halfway through freshman year of high school, literally on my very first day of school, I was like, okay, what's this America all about? And so I go to school and I go into PE class and it's the final of square dancing. And I have to take the final. I'm like, but sir, I haven't done any square dancing ever before. And he's like, it's okay, just try your hardest. And then I got an A. I'm like, I don't understand how this grading system works. Not sure if I'm a great, and it's PE, people, PE.
Oh my God, square dancing.
Square dancing.
I don't even think we did square dancing in Texas.
This is in the Inland Empire. I have no idea why,
That actually makes me really happy. Is Inland Empire like what, Burbank? Is it like the valley?
So you keep going on the 10 freeway east, and you get to Claremont. And
yes.
That's the edge of LA County. And then I lived in Upland, which was right over the edge of LA County into San Bernardino County.
Gotcha.
Yep.
LA is such a weird place. I visited some friends yesterday. They're having a baby shower, and they live in Mar Vista, which for anybody who's listening who kind of has been to LA or knows LA is sort of on the other side of Culver City. It's quite close to the airport. It's in like what we call Silicon Beach near Playa Vista. And I live in Los Feliz, which is another neighborhood, and that's more east, and it's sort of northeast of Hollywood. I think that'd be a good way to put it. Both of us live in Los Angeles proper. Like, our city is both Los Angeles, and they're so fucking far away.
I know.
It's so weird.
I live in Koreatown, specifically very close to work, so I take the bus. It's like 6 miles. I can bike in half an hour.
Nice.
And so some weeks I won't even get in my car, which is... What more could one ask for? And then when you are out and you're at a thing and you're like, okay, now it's late and I just missed my last train, you can get a lift home.
That's so true. Yeah, don't you love that? We're like a mecca of... It's funny because people talk about how there's like bad public transit here, which is A, crazy. It's just that people don't really use it. It's not like New York. You know what I mean? New York's public transit is like a really big, crazy spiderwebby map. But also, New York is tiny. It's a small right. place. You know what I mean? LA is massive.
I mean, I'm part of a lot of organizations like Los Angeles Walks, and I'm friends with a lot of people who are in the LA County Bicycle Coalition and just all these pedestrian and public transit advocate friends. And so I walk a lot more than the average person. I take public transit a lot more than the average person. And I find it so easy. I can get on the bus and go to work and someone else is in charge for a little while, yeah. And I can like watch Netflix on the way to work, or I can answer work emails if I feel like really like I want to get a head start on the day and be a winner.
Overachiever.
Or someone who forgot to answer emails the day before.
Underachiever. Yeah. No, it's true. I try to have it both ways because I am from Texas, so I'm from a full-on driving culture, but that's why I drive EV because it's, I feel really guilty driving a gas car, so I just don't do it anymore. And living in LA, it's so easy to drive an electric car. Because even though you don't have much of a range, although that's about to change, you can pretty much get everywhere you want to go. And I love that the museum has like a shitload of electric car
I was just
going
to say, I'm like, we've got electric charging stations.
It's so good. And there's always one open when I go there, and I can always use up my car. And I'm usually there long enough that it's like fully charged by the time I leave.
And it's really easy to get there on the bus and the train.
That's true. It's literally right next to it.
Yeah, the new expo line, there's like two stops that are right there adjacent. And, you know, there's more and more stuff happening in Exposition Park. There's K-pop concerts happening in the Coliseum. Don't ever try to drive anywhere near the Coliseum when a K-pop concert's happening. And then, you know, soccer stadiums. I think... that the Raiders are coming. I don't know anything about sports.
I don't either.
Just totally.
We can't. Yeah. We're gonna get emails now. Yeah, we're like, the sport of
sportsing.
Aren't we getting a football team?
Yeah, isn't that the Raiders?
Oh, I thought
we talking about American football.
Yeah, American
soccer?
Football.
Yeah.
Yeah, not.
Yeah, we should probably change the subject
Let's
right
now.
Let's
not talk about sports anymore. So, dinosaur.
Bugs.
Yeah, so you're like a bug fanatic. You are in many ways. So you had or you what is your title again?
Manager of Citizen Science.
Manager. So you manage Citizen Science for the museum. One of your great joys is bugs. I know I did a really fun, campaign with the museum, and you helped me by putting bugs on my face,
yep.
which was amazing, and also by helping me have bugs crawl all over my hands, which I enjoyed immensely. And you're a pro with the bugs. Where did your love for bugs come from?
So I've always loved bugs since I was a kid. I would be out in my garden and, okay, I'm talking about snails now, which are admittedly not bugs, but I would take all the snails I found in the garden and put them in this little crook of a tree. I'm like, this is your snail home. And then they'd all like slither away. like, no, that's where you're supposed to live. So then I'd do it again the next day. And then I would like watch bumblebees and follow butterflies down the path to the farmer's yard and figure out where they were going.
Childhood you
had. And then I tried to dig up an ant's nest to find the queen, and I didn't get very far, but I think I killed a few ants, which I feel guilty about still to this day.
You do?
Yep.
I'm like, I pick and choose which bugs I want to be especially nice to and which ones I don't. So you are like equal opportunity bug lover. Like, you won't kill a cockroach?
Oh, I've totally killed a cockroach in my own house. But, you know, if I see an American cockroach on the street, I'm going to take a picture of it instead of try to kill it.
But if it's, like, crawling towards your bed, like, you'll take action?
Like, if it's a spider, I'm going to, like, get a little cup and take
me
it
too.
Outside.
Me too.
Like,
I never
Grandpa
kill
told me.
Or sometimes I actually just let them live. Like, if I see a spider in the corner of my house, I'm like, eat all the mosquitoes.
Yep.
It's like I get all excited.
Yeah, especially if it's the ones that are in the, like, webs that just kind of hang out in the corners.
Yeah.
Like, they're just going to stay there. But then sometimes you get these really big, kind of dark and hairy spiders that if they're walking across the floor in my bedroom, like, yeah, you could end up in my bed tonight and you're not exactly the who I want to share my bed with, so
yeah,
I'm gonna take you outside and put you in the plants.
That's true. I'm learning here, when we first moved in, I think because we have a lot of construction going on and the front door's left open a lot when the guys are coming and going, we actually had a lot of mosquitoes at first, which was weird to me because I didn't know we have mosquitoes in LA. I think that's new and it's bumming me out. And then roly-polies, which is what we call them from Texas. Do you call them roly-polies?
So I call them, in England, we call them wood lice. And there's also, in certain parts of England, they're called cheese logs. I'm not kidding, cheese logs. And
wood lice and cheese logs.
Yeah.
And here I feel like people call them either roly-polies or pill bugs.
Yeah, that's the two that I get the most from kids at the museum.
Oh, so maybe it's both here in LA. Interesting.
I've totally heard both.
Yeah. It was definitely like a pill bug would be confusing. If somebody in Texas was like, I found a pill bug, we'd be like, what the hell is a pill bug? Definitely a roly-poly. I mean, that's what they look like. There might be two dead roly-polies in the corner.
Oh my god, we should iNaturalize them.
We should. Can you see them from where you are?
I can totally see
those
them.
Those are totally roly-polies, aren't they?
They look like roly-polies.
They do. Yeah, it's weird. We have a lot around here, which is actually fun. I feel like if you're going to find a bug in your house and it's a roly-poly, you're like, yay!
Some people, I don't know if I've ever met anyone who's totally freaked out by roly-polies.
Yeah, they're the easiest. I feel like they're
a gateway bug.
A gateway bug,
I mean,
exactly.
They're technically not an insect or a bug.
Oh, you're right.
They're terrestrial isopods.
They're isopods that are like crustaceans,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yep.
But would you still call that a bug? Does an insect have to be a bug?
Technically speaking, for it to be a bug, it has to be in the true bug order or Hemiptera. And so some people who are really pedantic about words, which I'm not one of those people, get really bent out of shape when you call something a bug that's not a Hemipteran.
So is a Hemipteran, is an arachnid a Hemipteran?
No. So
spiders can't be bugs.
No.
Oh, shit.
Technically. But we call it the bug fair, and we've had Year of the Spider at the bug fair. So there's like people who get really bent out of shape about certain words. And in my mind, I'm like, oh, sorry, I'm calling it a ladybug. I know it's not a ladybug. It's a beetle, right? So some people are like, no, you have to call them ladybird beetles.
Ladybird beetle. That's its real name.
Well, in England, we call them ladybirds.
Oh.
And it's obviously not a bird either, people.
Yeah.
It's not a bird.
Was it named for Lady Bird Johnson? Like, where did that name come from? I'm looking this up right now.
Yeah, you should look it up.
Lady Bird Beetle is the real name.
Yeah, Lady Bird.
I have no idea. Is it one word or... Well, I'm going to try it.
Lady Bird is one word.
It is. Okay.
Obviously, space, beetle.
Yes.
But they're beetles in the family Coccinellidae.
You're so good. That's what it says on
Wikipedia. And they're in the order Coleoptera. which is why my Instagram handle is Kalila Optera.
I love that.
One of my friends, I go to this geeky insect conference in Arizona. And one of my friends, Larry Reeves, he's a cool bug dude. He's like, you've got the worst Instagram handle. We should change it right now. It should be something buggy. I was like, okay, ideas. And he's like, Kalila Optera. I'm like, no one is ever going to, that's so dumb. And then I was like, okay, I'm using it.
No, it's so good. I love it. Okay. So tell me how to pronounce it again. Coccinellidae?
Coccinellidae.
Coccinellidae. So the name coccinellids is derived from the Latin word coccineus, meaning scarlet. The name ladybird originated in Britain, where the insects became known as Our Lady's Bird or the Lady Beetle. Mary, Our Lady, was often depicted wearing a red cloak in early paintings, and the spots of the seven-spot ladybird, the most common in Europe, were said to symbolize her seven joys and seven sorrows. And fucking the religious ladybug.
And the red cloak was dyed red with a bug, too.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, cochineal insect.
Oh,
scale
crazy.
Insect, which they smush up, and it's sometimes they put it in, you know, red food coloring, too.
Do we have those? So like a ladybug?
No, like it's a scale insect, have you ever seen, on cactus, you walked around and seen cactus with like white, cloudy, puffy looking things
yes.
growing on it? That's cochineal.
Oh.
And if you go inside of all that white, waxy, filamentous stuff that they keep themselves nice and hydrated inside of, and protected from predators, there's a little tiny red insect in there. And if you squish it, it looks like red stain all over your fingers.
No way.
Yeah.
I'm learning so much right now. I'm looking up scale insects and I'm seeing a picture of an adult cottony cushion scale, which is a crazy looking bug. That's a bug, right?
Yep.
These are bugs.
Yep.
Because they're Hemiptera. Hemiptera is a bug?
Well, so when I was in college, there was Hemiptera and Hemoptera, and I think that their scale insects are in Hemoptera, but now they've changed things.
Gotcha.
So like,
true, but
now I sound like an old person.
Did you study entomology?
Yeah,
college?
So
you did.
I
was like, how do you know all this shit?
I went to UC Riverside for my undergrad, and it's one of the few programs around here that you can study insects.
That's awesome.
For 4 years.
Do you get an entomology degree, or is it a biology degree with like an entomology focus?
No, we actually have a whole entomology
That's
program
so
at UC
cool.
Riverside, and it's really cool because there was only 3 undergrads when I was there in the entomology program, a whole bunch of grad students, which was a little annoying when you were taking tests and you had all these grad students in your class with you, and you're like, oh, I'm never going to get a good grade because all those people are like know so much more about bugs than I do. Sorry, insects. but now working at the museum, 2 of the other people that work there, they also graduated from UC Riverside. And so it's 3 female entomologists all graduated from UC Riverside. Myself, Emily Hartop, who's described the 30, now 42 species of fly. And then Lisa Gonzalez, who's the one who works on Bioscan and goes and collects the jars every week and then does crazy amounts of sorting and just makes the whole thing run really smoothly.
And are they staff entomologists or are they also in the citizen science program?
So no, they work in research and collections. Mm-hmm. And so I think their title is assistant curator.
Gotcha.
Or collections manager. Oh, messing up people's titles.
It's very confusing. The way museums work and operate, it's very confusing.
Well, and it varies from museum to museum greatly.
Which makes it extra confusing. I met the scientist in the malacology lab. Did I say it right?
Yes.
When I was...
Jan Vendetti?
Yes. When I was filming the fun thing, because we were talking about, what kind of snails were they? Chestnut snails.
Glyptostoma.
That smell like chocolate.
Oh, they're, and the shells are so brown and chocolatey
perfect.
Looking.
They are chocolatey. And they, even like just the shells smelled like chocolate, which was super weird to
There's
me.
Just the sheen on them. Oh, it's beautiful.
So you're a big snail fiend.
I am
now.
Snails. I didn't realize how cool. I mean, I always liked snails and I would like taking pictures of snails. And again, I had that snail like little enclosure, like crook of the tree that I. So just, me and snails go way back. But I didn't really know about the snails here in LA until we started the slime project. Snails and slugs living in modified environments. Slime. Another acronym that came was Brian Brown's brainchild.
Yeah.
So Jan, our snail, our malacologist, has become a terrestrial land snail and slug expert now. And I had no idea that there were so many critically imperiled and imperiled species here in LA.
Oh, interesting.
And that we just really didn't know. And so through the Citizen Science Project, we've got people sending in pictures of all of these amazing snails. And we're learning so much, and there's still more to be learned. And we just had the first El Nino snail blitz, which ended on April 14th, and we're announcing the winners tomorrow.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah.
And that'll be when this podcast comes out. It's going to come out tomorrow.
I won't divulge who the winners are.
So wait, tell me, what is a snail blitz? Or it's like a bio blitz, right? It's specifically for snails.
Yeah. So we were specifically looking at land snails and slugs here in the greater LA area. So the five counties, including LA. And all you have to do is take a picture of said snail or slug, or even just the shell, mm-hmm. If there's no snail alive in it, and then send it into the museum. You can do that a couple different ways. You can email it to us at nature@nhm.org. You can hashtag snail blitz, or now you can hashtag nature in LA because the snail blitz is over, mm-hmm. and on social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. And then also if you have iNaturalist, which is a free app for Apple and Android phones, you can just upload it directly to the project that way.
And do you have to tag it on iNaturalist? Or do you just know because it's geotagged to
you
be LA?
You can join the project. You can join the slime project, and then you can kind of click it on. So Jan is on iNaturalist, and every other day, she goes and looks for pictures that people have submitted and helps to identify them. And then if it's something really cool, she'll come to your yard, if you want her to look for the snail or slug. And you know, sometimes it's really hard to get an ID from just a picture.
Yeah. So those chestnut snails, that was a citizen scientist. That was like a guy on a hike that was like, this is a cool snail. And it happened to be a species that we didn't know lived in LA.
So I'm not 100% sure on this story. I think it was Cedric Lee, who's one of our main citizen scientists. Amazing.
Oh, so he's like really into it.
Oh, Cedric's amazing. He helped us win the City Nature Challenge that was just this last week.
Yes, and we have to talk about that too.
Yeah, so much. But Cedric is a student at UCLA, and in his spare time, which I'm sure he doesn't have that much of, mm-hmm. he is out and about logging nature observations from all over the county, all over the Southern California region, and finding really cool things. And he has a really amazing eye for snails and slugs. Like some of these snails, there's one called the vertigo snail, and it's so tiny, it's like tinier than an eraser.
Wow.
And Jan has this picture of a slug and then the vertigo snail on top of the slug going like for a little ride, and then another snail right next to it. So like three different species in one. And that may or may not be one of the winners of the snail blitz.
Interesting. So Cedric just kind of, did he know when he found the chestnut snail? Like, oh, this is just a snail? Or was he like, holy crap, why is there a chestnut snail in LA?
So Cedric's pretty on top of things.
Yeah.
And he's been using iNaturalist for a long time. So it was him and one of the other power users is what mm-hmm. we call them. James Bailey, who's a recent high school graduate, telling me about, you know, oh yeah, maybe it's this species or that species of the roly-poly. I'm like, wow, you know the different species of pill bugs or earwigs. And he's like, well, there's two species here, the most common ones. And which one is it? And I'm like, I don't even know this stuff, guys. And you guys don't have any degrees in entomology, and you know way more than I do. It's totally amazing.
Oh my God, that must be so exciting. Especially when they're kids like that. Like, it's a kid.
Meeting them in real life, well, because you've seen them on... I've seen them on like iNaturalist, and you see them logging thousands of observations, and you have like this conversation with them. And then we invited our power users to come to an event that we were holding at Griffith Park. And so I got to meet Cedric in real life for the first time. And you're just like, these people are so awesome. And now we have Cedric come. He comes and meets with us, and he's like, I've got ideas about how we can make sure we win the City Nature Challenge. Can I come meet with you? I'm going to be at the Science Center. I was like, Cedric, we would love for you to come meet with us and tell us what we should do.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So the City Nature Challenge literally just ended.
Literally just ended on the 21st, and we announced the winners on the results on the 22nd Earth Day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Earth Day was just 2 days ago as of this recording. So the City Nature Challenge was a challenge between LA and San Francisco only?
This year, yeah.
and so how did it work?
Grand plans. So I've been thinking about doing something like this since 2011. I was at a Geeky Citizen Science conference at the American Museum of Natural History, and it was all these citizen science practitioners in the room, and I was sitting next to someone from the Natural History Museum of London. I was like, wouldn't it be cool if we had a competition between LA and London to see who has the most nature on a day? And my friend John was like, that would be really awesome. And then we both got busy with other things, and we've collaborated on things, and we've done presentations at conferences before. But then it really ended up coming to fruition with my friend Allison Young, who works at Cal Academy, and her colleague up there, Rebecca. And they were like, what are we going to do for Citizen Science Day, April 16th, the first one? Could we do something that's kind of collaborative? I'm like, oh my gosh, let's do the City Nature Challenge. And Allison had been thinking and talking about doing it for a while. So then we're like, this is it. This is the time. Let's make it happen.
And so the idea was to take a picture of anything, just nature, right? So how did you win? Was it about having more breadth or more submissions?
So we had multiple categories. We were, so we decided to have it not be just one day. Because we thought that might be a little intense. So we decided to do a whole week instead because, you know, that's not more intense.
Yeah, because it's so much easier to count a whole week's worth of submission.
Yeah, so we're going to debrief about this and figure out how to make it a tiny bit easier on ourselves. But it was so fun. Yeah, you could send in a picture of any plant, animal, mushroom, so a living thing. It could also be something dead that showed was evidence of life, so scat or tracks. You could also have audio recordings. iNaturalist accepts audio recordings, so like cricket recordings,
bird songs,
bat sonograms. And so you can submit any of those to iNaturalist. And it was only LA County for us, and then it was the 9 counties in the Bay Area, which we cover. We have about a few more people down here in LA, but it was about the same number of people, about the same amount of geographic space. And San Francisco had killed us every single data point that Cedric looked at, because Cedric was like, I don't think we're going to win, guys. Oh, no. If you look at the data, the last 3 months, San Francisco has beat us. If you look at just the 1 month, they really beat us. But then if you looked at this 1 week, they were like beating us, but not by that much. And he's like, maybe we could pull it out because it's only for a week, and if we really engage our power users. And I was like, yep, Cedric, that's exactly what we need to do. I'm like, thanks for telling us.
We're like, so basically, Cedric, you need to be all up on iNaturalist.
Well, he was. He was the number one contributor to the project. You know, San Francisco power users were amazing, but Cedric, I don't know. Cedric and then James Bailey, who is Silver Sea Star Song on iNaturalist, that recent high school graduate, they both had the highest number of submissions.
And so there were multiple categories. Did we sweep San Francisco, or were there just certain categories that we won in?
So we did sweep San Francisco, which I am just so shocked. And obviously we're all winners in the end because we're all working towards collecting biodiversity data for California. But yeah, we ended up winning. And the prize is nothing more than bragging rights, but I find I have a hard time bragging, so I'm going to try really hard.
I'm awesome at
bragging.
We
totally kicked San Francisco's biodiversity booty, and we had more observations. We had over 10,000.
And
yeah, when I was interviewed by Deborah Netburn from the LA Times about this, she was like, how many do you think we're going to get? And sometimes words just come out of my mouth without me thinking. I'm like, 10,000. And then my friend Allison's like, are you insane? She's like, I heard her nervous laugh on the end. She's like, I don't think we're going to get that many, but we want to get 10,001 because we obviously want to beat LA. But yeah, we got over 10,000 observations. We also got more species than San Francisco. And I forget the exact numbers. It was like right around 1,500.
Seriously?
Yeah, and then we had also more people participating because we not only accepted submissions via iNaturalist, we also accepted submissions via Instagram using the hashtag NatureInLA, Facebook, and Twitter, and then the email as well. And so we had 150, maybe more people submit that way. So I think it was like somewhere right over 400 and odd people.
So iNaturalist was still kind of the popular route.
Well, because it's just so easy. Like, you can... I had a friend who started using iNaturalist really for the challenge. She had made 2 submissions before, but she like logged like 98 submissions for the challenge. I'm like, oh my gosh, I love it when my friends totally come through.
And so let people who are listening right now, because anybody can use iNaturalist, right? This is not an LA thing. This
anywhere in the world.
Anywhere in the world. So it's an app that you can download for free. Yep. And then you take photos, you take sound recordings, and you upload them. And you can either identify it yourself or you can ask for help identifying, right?
Yep. Yeah, they make it super easy and they're always upgrading their user interface. So you can access your camera on your phone and take a picture right then and there, or you can access your library and put a picture in that way.
In case if like you're somewhere remote and you don't have LTE.
And then you can easily get your geolocation and the date, and so that metadata goes in, which makes it really easy for the scientists because that information is already there. Because they obviously need to know where that reptile was, not just like, it was in LA somewhere, but they want to know kind of where in LA. In someone's backyard? Okay, what were the cross streets? And then you can try to figure out what it is. And if you just know that it's a plant, you can put plants, and then it will pop up and, you know, put them in the plant kingdom. If you know it's a flowering plant, you could put flowering plants. If you knew it was a ladybug, now you would know, oh, Coccinellidae, and you put that in.
But if you don't know, you can put in what you do, and then...
And then you can press the little button, swipe the button over that says, need ID help.
Nice.
Yep. Nice. And then you can add it to projects, and then you press save, and then it syncs it. You can sync it later when you have Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
I have unlimited data somehow. I lucked out. And so I'm just like iNaturalist anywhere, anytime, people.
And how cool is that to be able to do also when you're traveling someplace you've never been before?
I love using iNaturalist when I'm traveling. Uploaded loads of pictures from when I was in Bali, in Malawi. Yeah. I mean, I try not to like just be on the phone when I'm in other countries. I want to be experiencing the nature. But when I see a cool insect or a cool spider, I am 100% going to try and take a picture of it right then and there.
Yeah, how do you not if you're like on a hike in a new location and then you see these living things and they're kind of like, you don't know what I am.
Yep.
Like, I have to document this.
Yeah, when I was in Bali, so we have the spider pavilion at the museum, right? And so I get to help collect spiders for the spider pavilion, and mostly they're from New Orleans in the swamps, and they're huge. They're about the size of a like tea saucer. Okay, what's the American version of that? A bread plate.
Yeah, I think a tea saucer is smaller than a bread plate.
Okay, so they're a little bit bigger than a tea saucer. Bread
they're
plate.
They're like the size of your hand.
Yeah,
open.
There you go.
They're
that's,
big.
That's how big these golden silk orb weavers from New Orleans are.
Jeez, and so people think, so we have a spider pavilion, which is like a room at the museum where certain times of the year you can walk through and see all these amazing spiders. I guess you, in your head, you're like, oh, they get delivered from some. But of course, no, people go out and collect them.
Yeah,
and
so
put them in the spider
I get
pavilion.
To go some years I get to go and collect them. I get to hang out with a friend, Zach Lemon, who is the Cajun bug chef, and he works for the Audubon Insectarium. We go out on a boat with him and his friend who owns this swampland, and we go collect these giant spiders.
Are they dangerous spiders?
They do have venom, but they are not...
They're not very bitey.
They're not very bitey, and B, their venom is very, very mild.
Gotcha.
So it doesn't really affect us humans in any adverse way. I've never been bitten by them, and I've handled them a lot.
Yeah.
But we collect them, and then we put them inside of a tiny Ziploc container that we have made holes in, and then put some wet, like perfectly wetted down paper towel, not too wet because it won't work, and not too dry because the spider needs moisture, and they get overnighted to the museum. And so they show up and then they get released into the pavilion, and you have to start in the back of the pavilion and move forward, because if you do it the other way around, then they immediately start putting out webs and you get stuck in the back and because they're like shooting their web everywhere. And they're like, yeah, time to like make webs. And then we feed them crickets and other insects every every other day or three times a week.
And how many do you usually put into the pavilion?
So it depends, but usually we start off with 100. And then we also have other spiders that are local species, local old beaver species that we also put in there.
And they're all just like separate or some of them in cages?
So we have a few cages in the beginning to get people used to the being around spiders experience. And then we also have some species up there that you wouldn't be able to have in a free open enclosure. So we have some giant tarantulas and things.
Gotcha.
And ground-dwelling spiders. But the only spiders that are in the pavilion space, which is the same space that the butterfly pavilion is in, are the orb weavers. So, like, you know, they basically just hang out on their web.
But
so
they're, like, right there. You're like,
they're right there.
Spider.
But we make sure that if they make their web over the pathway, that we move their web for them.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Have you ever had just, like, a really tall person go through?
We make sure that we think about heights of people and all of that. But then sometimes we're like, watch out. You've got a duck over here. Yeah. The spider pavilion's amazing.
I'm so glad that we have that here because I think hopefully people listening have probably been to a butterfly pavilion somewhere. You know, it's not like a completely new concept. I think I went to a really beautiful butterfly pavilion at the Natural History Museum in Houston once. The Houston Natural History Museum is legit. And also I think in Philadelphia I've been to a butterfly pavilion. Yes, I know I have in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, because I know that there's the, I know some of the people who work at the museum there in the live animal section.
In Philly or in Houston?
Yeah, in Philly.
Yeah, I feel like I definitely have been, but probably a solid, now I'm going to age myself, probably a solid like 8 years ago when I was in grad school. I mean, last month. And yeah, it's so much fun. But, you know, it's like butterflies that are, it's rare that somebody's going to be like afraid of butterflies flying around, but people are scared of spiders.
We've had people scared in the pavilion of the butterflies just because it's like,
really?
It's kind of intense. A lot of butterflies flying around your head.
Yeah, and they'll land on you too.
Yeah,
like they're cool.
If you're lucky.
It. Yeah.
Or if you're scared, unlucky.
Or if you know what you're doing, hence why I had butterflies on my face for that campaign. That's all Leela.
Butterfly wrangler.
It was amazing.
Yeah, but the spider pavilion is definitely something that's much more unique, and you don't really get that experience many places. And we've been, I forget how many years we've been doing it for, but lots of years. And yeah, I mean, getting up close and seeing their webs and seeing the architecture of their web and the different designs that the different spiders utilize and the different color silks. Yeah, it's also something I didn't really know much about before I started working at the museum. And I'm like, I studied entomology, insects or arachnids, so that's arachnology. I don't do
yeah.
that. But then people start asking you all these questions about spiders, and you're like, okay, got to have some answers. And then you start learning about them, and you're like, oh my God, spiders are amazing. All those like little spinnerets they have on their abdomen and like pumping out the silk. Yeah.
It is really cool.
It's
beautiful. They're like snowflakes.
They're so amazing, and the fact that they can make all these different kinds of silks and put all these proteins together, and then they can eat the silk at night and then remake new silk the next day. And they've, you know, I think it was radioactive isotopes that they used, and they could see that the materials and the atoms that were in the web and the silk that they had eaten basically is coming out right afterwards in the new silk they're making. So
that's
they're
incredible.
Really good recycling.
Yeah. Wish we could do that.
Right?
Yeah. We probably shouldn't eat anything that came out of our body.
We're also going to steer
Sometimes
clear
my
of
dog
that
does
sports.
That, but yeah, that's not really a skill that I possess. Yeah. So you, does citizen science at the museum do a lot of crossover with these other, I guess, kind of departments? Like the museum here in LA is really special, I think, because we have the Nature Lab, which not a lot of museums have, this very interactive part of the museum where you can look at bugs and you can look at mammals and you can look at all of these different organisms. Some are alive, some aren't alive, and then you can go outside and you can play in the dirt, which is really fun. So you utilize all of these different exhibits at the museum in your citizen science initiatives, right?
Yeah, so I was on the Nature Lab, the team that worked on designing that space, and I was also on the team that worked on designing the nature gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And because as the nature gardens were happening, we were trying to figure out what exact kind of programming is going to happen. And we've been doing citizen science for a while at the museum. We had a parrot project in 1994 that our curator, or collections manager of ornithology, Kimball Garrett, started.
Parrot project?
Yeah. So have you seen green, bright green fluorescent birds flying around that are squawking really loud?
I have not, but I have heard that we have a parrot species here in LA.
So we have, I think it's actually 14 species.
We have 14 parrot species here in LA. That's the weirdest thing I've ever heard, that we have parrots in LA.
I just love these kinds of stories about the nature that's here now. And we humans have totally come in and changed the whole landscape of the space. And we bring in animals and we bring in plants. And sometimes we accidentally bring things in. And to me, this is really, let's look at what makes up the nature of Los Angeles. And these introduced species are one component of that, for better or for worse. And the parrots are really loud, and sometimes people really don't like the sound, but then they're really beautiful. And so, you know, there's all of these components, and then are they negatively impacting mm-hmm. our native species? Again, all of these questions, really, really interesting. Be that as may, we know that there are about 14 species of parrots that are here and have populations. There's lilac-crowned parrots, there's the yellow chevron parakeets, which are the ones that I see the most. And yeah, so they're all over the place and they're squawking up a storm. And Kimball figured out that these 14 species were here through citizen science.
That's so cool.
And then we started our spider survey, and that started in 2001, and that was Brian Brown, our entomologist again, who started that. And now we have about 5,500 specimens of spiders that people have sent into the museum, and we have a really good idea of what spiders are here and whereabouts they are. And so now the project's kind of morphed into, we're just looking at the bioscan site hosts and using the spider survey. So Jan Kemp, one of our volunteers who's been running the spider survey for a really long time, I like to call her one of our uber citizen scientists, mm-hmm. She goes out to the site hosts and looks for spiders in the backyard, and Lisa Gonzalez goes out too. So they're looking for all of these amazing spiders and seeing what species people have in their backyards as well, so then we can compare and contrast and think about what's going on in these people's backyards, not just the insects with these malaise traps, but also now the spiders, and also the reptiles and amphibians for the Rascals Project, and also the squirrels from the Squirrel Project, and also the snails and slugs from the Slime Project. So we're really looking at people's backyards in this big, crazy, interesting way, and figuring out how do the things that we do in backyards increase or decrease biodiversity, increase or decrease introduced or invasive species. And that's really, you know, we just had this big press launch last Thursday, and it was announcing the Urban Nature Research Center, which is the coalescing of all of these different citizen science projects, the scientists all working really closely together, and then working closely with the citizen science office. So we're in education, so the researchers are all in what's called research and collections, and then we have crazy amazing partnership with marketing communications. So mm-hmm. again, we kind of jumped around, but I know you were saying that we at the museum, it's this really interdepartmental thing, and not all museums back in the day, it was very siloed, and the educators did XYZ, the researchers worked over here and did their thing, and then marketing communications did their thing, and it was less integrated and
which
working
is crazy.
Together.
It makes no sense. What is the point of doing education if you're not going to access what's happening in the research? You know what
yeah.
I mean? It's it makes no sense. But it's so crazy to me to think, okay, when you were mentioning all of the projects that are going on, Slime, which is snails and slugs, Rascals, which is
Reptiles and amphibians.
You talked about Bioscan. You talked about the spiders. You talked about the squirrels. It's almost like some of these super important initiatives, the things that we're spending a lot of real energy on, are the types of organisms that I think a lot of people think of as being sort of mundane. You know, it's funny, the things that, oh, well, yeah, of course I see squirrels all the time. Or
yep.
what's so important about flies? Flies are everywhere. But taking the time to look at these things that we think of as being mundane and actually documenting them and cataloging them can tell us, and especially can tell scientists, so much about what's happening in our own backyards, which is incredible, because you would almost think that if you ask somebody, like, would you like to contribute to a citizen science initiative by telling us what kind of wildlife you see? They'd be like, well, I don't see, like, coyotes very often, so I don't think I'd be much help.
It's I've like, heard no, people no. say that many times. And, you know, again, you could have a critically imperiled snail in your backyard, and our scientists need to know about it.
Yeah.
Because literally no one's looked for how many years since the museum lost had the curator who cared about local snails.
And then the crazy thing is, if you did have a critically impaired snail in your backyard, and you knew that this snail liked living in your backyard, and then you could figure out what the snail was eating in your backyard, you could actually, like, start to cultivate, you know, a wild area in your own home that actually invites more of these snails to live there. That's what's so cool. Like, even if you just have, like, a planter outside of a window, like a little window box or a potted plant, like, you're inviting wildlife to your home.
Yeah, I especially like thinking and talking about this, you know, for downtown Los Angeles, which is, you know, the most concrete part of the city. It's where all the high rises are. And again, it's the part of the city where people like nature. There's not really any nature here. This is, you know, maybe got some pigeons and some rats.
Yeah.
But there, and I've seen all three of those species in downtown LA, but there are so many other amazing species in downtown. We did a bio blitz around City Hall. And so we documented a whole bunch of native species, a really cool orb weaver that we found there, sand wasps, lots of sand wasps. So there's these little solitary wasps that are kind of like amazing, got this kind of green tinged color to their abdomen. And then they got these amazingly cool big eyes, and then they dig little holes in the sand, and then they provision, lay eggs down there and provision their nest with other insects for their babies to eat. And there is loads of these sand wasps there. So, and some really cool butterfly species and hummingbirds. And one of the guys who came to help us, one of the citizen scientists, he's like, I live right around the corner and I get hummingbirds all the time. But I didn't get hummingbirds until I put up window boxes, and then I put up a hummingbird feeder. And I remember him telling us the story. I was sitting there in my living room, and I was like, maybe I should put up hummingbird feeders. And he's like, I haven't really seen any hummingbirds. I don't think there's any hummingbirds here. And then literally right as he was thinking that, a hummingbird, like, kind of comes up from below, looks him in the eye, and he's like, it was like the hummingbird was telling me.
Yeah, he's like,
we're here.
Feed me.
Yeah. And so then he put up hummingbird feeders on both sides of his apartment, and he has seen, like, at one point he had about 25 or 30 hummingbirds at his two feeders at one time. And then I found out, I wrote a blog about it, and I found out that a group of hummingbirds is called, like, you know, it's a murder of crows or a conspiracy of ravens. It's a charm of hummingbirds.
Oh, and I thought that was amazing. That's so perfect.
Yeah.
He had a charm of hummingbirds.
Yes, in downtown.
That's really cool. And now you can urban beekeep, you know, even if you live downtown.
My friend just got is taking a beekeeping class, and she just is like full on becoming a beekeeper now.
It's very cool. I mean, I did a story, another story at KCT about urban beekeeping. That was actually this season, and I visited some people in Santa Barbara because they've been doing it for years because it's been legal there for quite a long time. And then a woman in LA who actually has a National Wildlife Federation.
Yeah, certified.
Yes, certified.
Awesome.
Garden, I guess.
Yep.
And she was amazing, and she had a hive. And so between the two of them, I also lucked out because as a reporter, you don't often get to get gifts, but I got free honey from and it was the best tasting honey I've ever had. You know, he clarifies his, and she does hers like straight off of the comb. So it was a little polleny, which was delicious. And yeah, I got to meet their bees. And it was just incredible to see how actually not that hard it is, especially because now there's new technology. The first person I visited, his name was Kelton Temby, and he actually invented this this setup called Eyes on Hives, I think. And it's a camera that you put in front of your beehive, and it uses like computer vision to count all the bees and to automate understanding their flight patterns. So apparently there's an orientation flight that baby bees
make. The waggle
make.
Dance.
Yeah, when they first leave. And they called it like the heartbeat of the hive. If your hive on average doesn't have this little heartbeat of the baby bees doing the orientation dance, it's probably quite sick. But because, you know, you're not really supposed to open your hive that often. And so it's like this digital way from your phone that you can look at your hive and figure out if it's doing well so that you don't have to open it and bother the bees that often. I just love that. I love this cool kind of confluence of living in a city, having a really wonderful appreciation of nature, and then using technology to actually improve your relationship with nature. Yeah. It's almost counterintuitive, but it's happening everywhere.
Well, that I'm totally on the same wavelength. I just, you know, all these people that say, you know, put your phone down, go and like enjoy nature. I'm like, I can enjoy nature with my phone and I'm taking pictures of it so that I can identify these things later. And, you know, I think for, you know, kids, I grew up in this totally idyllic nature outdoors space. And I felt really lucky to have had that. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to work on the nature gardens at the museum, because I wanted to create a safe nature place where kids could come and play, get their hands dirty, put their feet in a pond, you know, all those kinds of things. And so now that's built, but we want kids, we want to meet them where they're at. And so if we tell them they have to take their phones away and all of that, I think sometimes you're going to lose some people. So why not utilize the phone as a way to get closer and more connected with nature? And you can, again, use the iNaturalist app for that, citizen science, taking pictures, Instagramming amazing nature photos.
And also sometimes you're not lucky enough to live in a place. LA is a very special place, I think, because you can both be in the city and like buildings on all sides of you. But if you look up, you actually see like mountain ranges and these incredible sunsets over the palm trees. But not everybody's that lucky. Like if you live in New York, you're not going to have these big nature vistas, right? So when it's like, oh, get off the phone and just appreciate nature, like sometimes what that means is looking at things that are tiny. You know, it's like maybe the macro isn't as obvious, but enjoying the micro is really important. And so I have a lot of friends who get really excited. Like there's the Foldscope, right? This really fun portable kind of microscope so you can look at things. Or just buying like little macro lenses for your iPhone, which are super cheap.
Yeah.
That you can like strap to your phone lens and take pictures of things. It's just like really fun.
Yeah, we just found out that one of the researchers, the volunteers actually at the tar pits, was like, I wonder if we took some moss from outside in the garden. Now, this is not 45,000-year-old moss. It's not,
these are living moss.
It's not prehistoric from the tar pits moss. This is moss that was growing in the garden outside.
So this is just moss that's living where the tar pits happen to be right now, today. But
one of the volunteers went outside, took the moss, brought it back into the lab, wet it down and looked under the microscope, and they found water bears or tardigrades.
Yes, I love water bears.
I love them too. And I'm like, I'm going to write a blog about this. I haven't had a chance yet though, but we have not written a blog for Nature in LA about water bears. And now it's the perfect time because we have them here in Hancock Park. And what other places can we go find some moss and reconstitute it with water and see if there are water bears in there. Because like at the Natural History Museum in London, they had some moss that had been in the collection for like 100 years, totally dried out. They put water on it and water bears were still alive.
Because they're crazy awesome and can live in space. And can be frozen for like 10 years.
Oh my gosh. They're so cool. And they also just look so crazy when you look at their mouth parts and their faces. They're like, I am alien, but I live on your earth.
But also I'm kind of like fluffy and
cuddly. And tiny.
Now I'm going to do this because one thing that I never felt like I was that good at was photography or macro photography. I have a lot of friends who are really good. It's hard when your like best friends are legit entomologists.
And you're seeing their pictures and I'm like, oh,
I know. I'm
like, camera skills.
But one thing that I do have, because I was a biologist for many years, is a microscope. And how fun to go and take, like, I want to go in my backyard right now, which is all dirt, and just put some of that dirt under the microscope and see what lives back there, you know?
So you should talk to my friend Richard Hayden, who's the head gardener at the museum, and he took one of the soils classes, and so he actually is really good at identifying all the, you know,
types
micro
of dirt. Oh, the things that live in dirt.
Yeah, the microorganisms that live in dirt. And he's like, that's a rotifer or whatever.
That's so much fun.
Nematodes. I remember I took a class on nematodes when I was in college. So I can talk about nematodes a little bit.
I like worms. I don't want them like in my body, but I do like them.
Oh, we found planarians in the pond the other day.
I did a science fair in eighth grade with planarians and we won.
Did you cut them in half?
I did cut them in half because it's so cool to watch them regenerate. We taught them a little maze and then we cut them in half and we saw if both of their halves knew the maze.
And then I just read somewhere that if you feed the dead or the part of one to one who doesn't know how to do the maze and then it eats them and then it knows how to do the maze.
It's pretty
crazy. Did you do that too?
We didn't do that because we tried that and they like wouldn't eat.
I will not eat my brother.
Yeah, we were like, eat it. I've read about this. They like, wouldn't do it. We're like, fine, we're over it. We got our blue ribbon. We're very excited. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I saw your planarian picture on Instagram.
Yeah.
Speaking of, well, no, I don't want to do that part yet. We're getting close to the hour mark. Can you believe it? I could literally talk about all of this stuff for a long time, which I will because every time I come to the museum, I hang out with you, which is so much fun. But I want to ask you, I ask everybody the same two questions at the end of every podcast. And I want your perspective because I'm definitely interested in where it will be. And so the first question is the bummer question. So we'll get that one out of the way. My first one is, when you look to the future, in whatever context you like, whether it's like your own personal future or kind of the future of the planet, what is the thing that concerns you the most, sort of keeps you up the most at night? And then after that, the flip side question is, what are you most excited and hopeful about?
I think to answer the bummer question first, I get really bent out of shape about when we're trying to get people to do better behaviors. And the green guilt and the eco fatigue set in. I'm like, this is not how we're going to change people's opinions. You can like do all this bummer information. You can put all the statistics up there. And is that what is going to change someone's behavior and make them act in a better way that's going to be better for the future of the planet? And I think the answer is like overwhelmingly, almost all the time, no. Mm. That's just going to make them really depressed and bum them out and not motivate them to actually, then they'll go to sleep and they'll be like, I don't want to remember that. So I try to think about how can we communicate with people and interact with people to help them be motivated and to give them the skills that they need and to figure out the best ways to act for the future of the planet. And I like to do that in like really kind of the more local micro way. And so how can we change LA to be a better city for the future? How can we make it better for humans and for wildlife? And I think that citizen science is absolutely one way to do that. If we don't know what's here and where, then we're working on incomplete data sets. And so conservation decisions are being made on a daily basis, urban planning decisions are being made on a daily basis, and if we don't have good data or good recommendations from scientists for what are the best plants that are going to use the least amount of water but support the most amount of wildlife, help with the urban heat island effect, then we're going to be making, you know, less informed decisions about what the street trees are or what the trees and plants are that I should be planting in my backyard. You know, there's a lot of good resources and data out there now about what you can plant in your backyard. But I think with more research, again, we know a lot about the mammals here in LA. We know a lot about the birds. But like the insects, like completely almost unknown. We don't have any data. We have estimates.
Yeah.
From what Brian has been working on with Emily and the Bioscan crew, he's made an estimate that through the number of forage that we have found here, the forage flies, that is, he thinks it's going to be about 22,000 species of insects live in LA.
That's crazy.
We know that there's about 500 species of bees that live in LA County.
Wow.
But yeah.
I didn't even know there were that many species of bees.
Yep.
And like, there's like honeybees and bumblebees.
And sweat bees and leaf miner bees.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And then you can actually, and that's something that I think people don't think about. They're like, well, my backyard is like grass and trees, like, and maybe I grow some vegetables. But no, you can literally choose what plants you put in and they will attract, like you can play God in your backyard if you want. You can be like, I really want monarch butterflies. So I will, you know, plant the right plants so that the caterpillars will grow so that I will have the monarchs. Like, you can actually choose how to make your little oasis invite the organisms that you want back there.
Yeah, and I live in an apartment, and so I have like zero control over this. I mean, sometimes I like talk to my landlord and like, why do we have lawn here? And he's like, oh, you're just the crazy lady who always talks about how you work at the museum and know about bugs, so I know what species of cockroach it is that happens to be in my living room or whatever. But so I haven't got my landlord to be making any changes yet. But, you know, I can go to public meetings about the parks that are happening in downtown, like Pershing Square is about to be redone. And there's a whole, I think, four groups who are like vying for the final design. And then there's a new civic park that's going in. And so I try to go to as many meetings as I can to say, hey, guys, it's really important that we have these spaces for humans, but we also need to make sure that we're creating these spaces that are going to work for wildlife too. Mm. And when we're around wildlife and the plants and animals, it makes actually us healthier. Have you ever heard of forest bathing?
No. That sounds so hippy-dippy.
I love the look on your face.
I'm like scared.
So, well, it's a thing from the Japanese culture. And so forest bathing is something you go do like for a weekend maybe. So I was forest bathing. Not only was I going into hot springs and hanging out camping, I was also forest bathing over the weekend. And scientists have been looking at this, and the chemicals that you breathe in when you're in the forest and the scents and the chemicals that were released from the trees and a whole bunch of other things, physical attributes, help to really calm you down, mm-hmm. and to release stress, and to they've found that it helps to lower chronic illness.
Interesting.
And so they're doing more and more research on
and
that.
And so when you say forest bathing, you mean like just being surrounded by the forest, not like taking off all your clothes and like rolling around in the forest, right?
No, I'm not going to do that. That sounds like you need to be on drugs to do that.
Yeah, it also sounds like I would like something would itch afterward.
Yeah, there was a lot of poison oak, so like
don't do that. But no, it is true. Just for me, like I discovered very close to a trailhead here, because now I'm basically like on the outskirts of Griffith Park.
Yeah.
And so there's a trailhead that takes me right into the park, and the first stretch of the hike is quite shaded. It's actually a place where I know that there are some interesting wildlife sightings that have happened there, but it's quite shaded and like surrounded on all sides, and it really is transformative just to go there and kind of be, it's the craziest, because you know that there's houses like right across the vegetation, but then every time I go out there, all I can think of is like, na 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 na. It's like so Jurassic Park, you know, especially because there's like conifers and things out there.
And P22 could be around the corner.
P22 has been around the corner, which is so exciting. So, oh my God, this was so much fun. Before you go, I do want because you especially, more than most of my guests, are somebody where I want to make sure people know your Instagram, where your blog is, like how to see what you're doing and even like say hi if they want. Because guys, you have to follow her on social media. There's so many beautiful pictures and really cool stories that she tells.
So on Instagram, I'm Kalila Optera. So that's Kalila Optera, which is basically my name, Leela, in the middle of Coleoptera, which is the order of beetles. And then on Twitter, I'm at Leela Mae Higgins. Facebook, Leela Higgins, and then we have a blog at the museum. And so if you just go to the nature site, so that's nature@nhm.org. No, that's the email. www.nhm.org/nature.
That makes more sense.
Yeah. You'll be able to find the blog right there, right on the homepage.
Cool. And I will link to that in the show notes too.
Awesome.
Oh, I love it. It auto-populated. So
yes.
Apparently I have gone there multiple times before. All right. Well, Leela, thank you so much for joining me. This was so much fun. I learned a lot, and I'm really looking forward to learning more from you in the future.
Oh my gosh. It was my pleasure. Thanks, Cara.
Of course. And everybody listening, thank you so much for coming back week after week. I'm looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.